Chapter 10. The irony of it all is that the Soviet Empire is largely one of our own creation. General Albert C. Wiedemeyer. I can hear the carping. But the USSR was our ally against Hitler. No, the USSR was not our ally. It was our secret master manipulator. We were secretly master manipulated, not into defeating the Nazis, who, but for the de facto Soviet occupation of Washington, I am now persuaded, could have been eliminated in 1943, but rather into decimating, obliterating Germany, Soviet Russia's natural barrier against expansion into its European empire. Japan, very much too, for that matter, in the East. Of course, D-Day was in 1944. I am about to describe another crime of the century, further establishing World War II as the war for Soviet aggrandizement and communist expansion. And somehow, the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B never sounds the same again. To see how this could be, we have to return to the first half of 1943, a busy time, particularly for Harry Hopkins. This is when we know from secret documents written by Soviet agents and gleaned from Soviet archives that Assistant President Hopkins twice covertly passed vital secrets to the Soviets. Both incidents took place around the time that evidence of Soviet guilt for the Katyn massacre was being uncovered, then covered up again, even as Stalin was breaking relations with the Polish government in exile over Polish calls for an independent investigation into the massacre. Not this rift among the Allies and not the Katyn massacre itself are even mentioned in Sherwood's official Hopkins biography. The two acts of espionage by Hopkins, which again, we only know about from chance Soviet sources, Matryokin's archive and Venona interceptions, were taking place in the same spring that the president's top advisor called up Major Jordan to ask him to speed a shipment of uranium along to Moscow on the QT. Jordan remains the only American to step forward as a witness to testify to Hopkins' perfidy. It was also in the same spring of 1943 that Dr. Joseph Mengele joined the staff at Auschwitz and began to conduct experiments on prisoners. Why mention this? It's important to fill in the timeline of civilization's destruction, to indicate what horrors had already been unleashed upon the world, and what horrors had not yet been unleashed upon the world, and might never have been. The spring of 1943 was also to draw a bright new strand into the loom when German Chief of Intelligence Admiral Wilhelm Canaris telephoned George H. Earle, former governor of Pennsylvania and special emissary of FDR, whom we met in Chapter 7, now in Istanbul, to inquire what might have come of the peace feelers the Abwehr director had 2 months earlier clandestinely extended in person to Earle to present to President Roosevelt. We are now entering more lost narrative, and I am wondering if even the notion that Canaris, a high official in the Third Reich, secretly aided British intelligence, let alone freelanced peace negotiations with Americans and the British, can ever penetrate the obdurate wall sheltering hoary consensus. It's just that hard to take. Nazi intelligence chief as good guy? In this attempt to rough out a new narrative that more accurately reflects events than the ideologically censored version we are familiar with, there is the risk of oversimplification. At this point, though, the far greater risk is overcomplication. These historical concepts are basic, and they underlie a national scandal. There existed many German anti-Nazis, even many high-ranking ones such as Canaris, who wanted to end World War II early. That's the basic concept. The chapter ahead tells how we ignored them and why, which is the national scandal. Our best interests, once again, were subverted for Soviet ends. There is a fleeting reference to the amazing anti-Nazi resistance movement in Germany in Chesley Manley's The 20-Year Revolution. He mentions in passing Alan Dulles' 1947 account, Germany's Underground, a book Dulles wrote about his personal wartime experience as our OSS man in Switzerland. In this slim book, Dulles recounts his extensive secret contacts with members of the anti-Nazi underground, which he kept OSS headquarters in Washington duly apprised of. Like a foreign correspondent whose newspaper never printed his reports, Dulles got nowhere with his work. The German anti-Nazi underground, Dulles makes clear, was the only anti-Nazi underground that wasn't supported by the United States. The reason is shocking and goes to the heart of the national scandal. This German underground movement was resolutely and operationally anti-communist just as much as it was anti-Nazi. In communist-occupied Washington, and London too, this particular wing of the anti-Hitler resistance was viewed as the enemy just as much as Hitler was. Alan Dulles, future CIA chief, doesn't paint the problem in the same bold strokes I have chosen, but I think he makes it plain. Dulles wrote, "The plotters were told clearly and repeatedly that we had made common cause with Russia in the determination to continue together to a complete and united victory. A majority of the conspirators favored England and the United States, and some even hoped that after they had removed Hitler, they might be able to surrender to the West and continue the war against the Soviets. This was known to Washington and London, and was one of the reasons they received no encouragement from the United States and Britain." In other words, anti-Nazis who were also anti-communist need not apply. This meant common cause with the communist regime superseded all, even German surrender. It was a brilliant strategy, from Stalin's point of view. A post-Hitler government in Germany that was both anti-Nazi and anti-communist would have blocked communist expansion into Eastern and Central Europe. The conspirators' general idea was to surrender German forces to Anglo-American armies on the single condition that German forces then be permitted, with undetermined Allied support, to redeploy to fend off a Soviet invasion of Europe and Germany in the East. In one of his many cables home about the German underground, Dulles elaborated, "The principal motive for their action is the ardent desire to prevent Central Europe from coming ideologically and factually under the control of Russia. They are convinced that in such event, Christian culture and democracy and all that goes with it would disappear in Europe, and that the present dictatorship of the Nazis would be exchanged for a new dictatorship." Their worst fears would start to come true with the Soviet invasion that rolled all the way to Berlin, as Khrushchev later pointed out in a burst of candor, on 500,000 trucks and jeeps made in the USA. "Clearly they must be stopped," was the Washington mantra. They didn't, however, mean the Red Army. During the Nuremberg trials in March 1946, the scope of this, yes, amazing anti-Nazi German resistance movement became briefly visible to the American public in a New York Times story whose headline underscores the point Dulles would make in his book. "Full story of anti-Hitler plot shows that Allies refused to assist." It's notable that the Allies' refusal to assist shares primacy with the full story of the anti-Hitler plot. This Allied failure was that newsworthy, although the Times doesn't probe too far. The intricacies of this mystery quickly receded from press attention, which, naturally, had riveted itself on the overwhelming revelations of Nazi evil. I say naturally, but I have to wonder, too, if there were any flickers of wonderment over the apparent fact that the Allies might have been able to prevent some of that evil by assisting the anti-Hitler plotters. A story almost too terrible to contemplate. Probably not, given the universal belief in the rock of the wartime alliance, even as it was already cracking up. For the record, the Times' explanation for the snub was, "Eden saw threat to Soviet amity," as the subhead put it, referring to British Foreign Minister Anthony Eden. What is not explained is why maintaining Soviet amity was valued more highly than bringing the war to a swift end. It is almost as if there were no need for such an explanation. Reporter and nephew of Times owner C.L. Sulzberger manages to convey a certain empathy for that amity. For example, the senior plotters, he writes, were morbidly suspicious of the Russians. One of their great failures, he writes, was not to reach out, as we would say today, to German socialists and communists who always suspected the conservative tinge of the putschists. More important to realize, however, is it wasn't just Eden who balked at helping this resistance. There were many, many others. It is Eden, however, who is singled out in this particular story for having refused to take action as early as 1942 on being passed a list of the chief German plotters originating with the Reverend Dietrich Bonhoeffer, on the ground that it might make the Soviet Union suspicious. Suspicious of what? The overthrow of Hitler? That same year, 1942, Nazi Germany's intelligence chief Canaris made contact with Sir Stuart Graham Menzies, British intelligence chief, from Menzies' obituary in 1968. It is said that had it not been for the Foreign Office's fear of offending Russia, that he might have established direct contact with the Admiral Canaris in 1942 on the removal of Hitler as a means of shortening the war. How did that fear of offending Russia, or raising Russian suspicion, become the leading driver of Allied war strategy? Even Dulles only knew the half of it, and only his Swiss slice of the German anti-Nazi effort. That is, his book doesn't include the simultaneous experiences of other Allied agents and emissaries, George H. Earle included. Still, what Dulles reveals is a sufficiently dedicated, if often hapless and unlucky network, to behold as a promise of what might have been, what likely would have been, were it not for the communist occupation of Washington. Dulles writes, "As the conspiracy developed, two leading figures emerged, Colonel General Ludwig Beck, chief of staff of the German army until the summer of 1938, and Karl Friedrich Gerdeler, a one-time mayor of Leipzig. Closely associated with them were former German ambassador at Rome, Ulrich von Hassel, and Johannes Papitz, the Prussian finance minister who had served under the Nazis and then turned against them. Among the most important military conspirators were Colonel General Kurt von Hammerstein, commander-in-chief of the German army from 1930 to 1934, General, later Field Marshal, Erwin von Witzleben, Beck, Gerdeler, von Hassel, Papitz, von Hammerstein, von Witzleben." Reciting these German names in an anti-Hitler context is almost like learning a new foreign language. Dulles continued, "General Eduard Wagner, quartermaster general, General George Thomas, head of the economic division of the planning staff of the army, Major General Hans Oster, chief assistant of Admiral Canaris, head of the Abwehr, and General Friedrich Ulbricht, and General Klaus von Stauffenberg, who had key positions in the replacement army, often called the Home Army." Dulles additionally lists two labor leaders, Wilhelm Lenchner and Julius Leber, and refers to the Kreisau Circle, a key group of conspirators drawn from the church, labor, business, and government, and centered about Helmut von Moltke. Only two among all of these men named above died from natural causes. The rest were executed by the Nazis or committed suicide first. That certainly doesn't fit the existing view. In fact, the average American reading Dulles's list would probably only recognize the name of von Stauffenberg, and mainly thanks, improbably enough, to Tom Cruise, who by chance decided to interrupt his string of outlandish action pictures to chronicle von Stauffenberg's failed attempt to assassinate and lead a coup against Hitler in the 2008 movie Valkyrie. This July 20th, 1944 episode marked the tragic climax of a star-crossed, long, and by the Allies unsupported German conspiracy against Hitler. Still, the very notion of such a conspiracy is probably fantastic to most Americans, who have remained largely bereft of the facts all these years. This resistance movement was real, all right, even if officially ignored. On May 10th, 1945, just a few days after the unconditional surrender of Nazi Germany, General Eisenhower saluted Europe's resistance forces, singling out anti-Nazis in France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Norway. "You fought on," he said, addressing them in a speech carried on the BBC, "regardless of the disappointments you suffered and of the danger you have undergone." Missing from the list was Germany, where thousands of bona fide anti-Nazis had been executed. It so happened that only a few weeks before Eisenhower spoke, Admiral Canaris himself had been hanged at Flossenbürg concentration camp for conspiring against Hitler. "Hanged twice," a witness later told a court hearing evidence against the SS guards who executed him and four other members of the July 20th, 1944 conspiracy, once to show him what death tasted like. That doesn't fit our existing view either. Nor does the fact that the Chabad Lubavitcher, a center of the Hasidic Orthodox Jewish community, in 2009 requested that Yad Vashem's Holocaust Memorial recognize Admiral Wilhelm Canaris as a righteous Gentile for saving 500 Jews from the Warsaw Ghetto. It's literally incomprehensible to a society shaped in some large part by vast armies of Nazi villains sweeping across pop culture, their understudies either CIA or corporate villains, ranging far beyond the time and bounds of the 12-year Third Reich, and with never a commissar, gulag guard, or show trial judge in sight. This may explain the jolt of uneasy recognition that comes from reading in The Captive Mind, Czesław Miłosz's famous study of communist totalitarian thinking, the reasons the Soviets encouraged a singular literary focus on the crimes of Hitler's Germany. Concentrating the reader's attention upon German atrocities channeled their hatred into a single direction and so contributed to the psychological preparation of the country, Miłosz wrote. Miłosz was talking about Sovietized Poland, circa 1951. What he describes, however, fits a stream of Hollywood movies over half a century, one proximate cause of our numbness when it comes to Soviet crime and all that. What does it tell us, though, about the psychological preparation of our own country? I believe Cruise's movie about the heroic German military underground, meanwhile, was an anomalous American first. Surely, this marks another triumph of the forces of concealment, but to what end? British journalist Ian Colvin, author of a remarkable, consensus-shattering biography of Admiral Canaris, offer some clues. Colvin's 1951 book, for the first time, made the case that not only was Canaris among the anti-Hitler plotters, but he was actually working as best he could under ridiculously dangerous circumstances during the war on behalf of British intelligence. Among his accomplishments, Colvin maintains that Canaris thwarted the assassination of Churchill, prevented Spain from joining the war, provided German troop movement information to the British, and withheld key intelligence from Hitler, all the while protecting the anti-Hitler plotters on his staff. It is this last accomplishment that may be the most significant, revealing a hidden stratum of war history. In other words, Canaris was not just a singular man. He symbolized a singular movement. The book, Colvin wrote, contains the disturbing assertion that the chief of German intelligence and a great number of his staff were in secret sympathy with the Allies before and during the war. Furthermore, that this movement of sympathy was known to the British Foreign Office, but either not sufficiently fostered to be useful or neglected. Let me count the ways. In his 1958 memoir, Wiedemeyer reports, General Wiedemeyer picks up on George H. Earle's series of secret negotiations with the German underground, which began with Canaris. Notably enough, these negotiations, which Earle didn't bring to public attention until 1958, came as news to Wiedemeyer, too, even though Wiedemeyer was himself a key military strategist of World War II. What's more important, Wiedemeyer agreed with Earle's contention that such a U.S.-German deal might have ended the war in Europe in 1943. What a staggering concept. Countless lives would have been saved, Wiedemeyer writes, And, of greatest importance, the Allies would not have supplanted one dangerous ideology for another. Before entertaining the implications here, there is an unexpectedly surreal aspect to this breathtaking meeting of the minds, Wiedemeyer's and Earle's, which is worth mentioning because it sheds light on the tenor of their time. Wiedemeyer first read about Earle's 1943 negotiations, not in a briefing paper, not in State Department records, not in a diplomat's memoir, not in a newspaper of record. He read about them in the pages of a supermarket-style tabloid, Confidential Magazine, a short-lived National Enquirer-style scandal sheet. It's hard to imagine that Earle set his sights on publishing this formidable story in Confidential. This suggests that the journals and papers of the day were unimpressed by Earle's yarn, weren't interested in publishing a history-changing account by a former governor and Roosevelt envoy about his secret peace talks with the head of German intelligence, who was later executed by Hitler. They weren't even moved by their own professional responsibility to preserve a historic, behind-the-scenes memoir of what was, let alone what might have been. Earle was also, by that time, notably anti-communist. Was that part of the problem? Amazingly, I was able to locate a well-preserved copy of the August 1958 edition of Confidential on eBay for about $10. I couldn't wait for it to arrive, and then there it was. Cover story headline, FDR's Tragic Mistake by George H. Earle, former governor of Pennsylvania. There was a page-filling shot of FDR's face, tip-top jaunty style, cigarette holder at attention. A list of secondary stories gracing the cover includes The Clinic for Female Frigidity, 20 Minutes to Live, A Death House Diary, A Cure for Excess Hair, Now Science Has the Answer. The more I read over these titles, the more I wondered how many times Earle was turned down by more respected publications. Oh well, three cheers for the rag that saved the story for the Republic, Confidential, which lived up to its motto, Tell the facts and name the names. Then again, maybe Earle wanted to get his story past the elites to the general public. According to Earle's account, he sent Canaris's initial query regarding a negotiated peace to the White House via diplomatic pouch in early 1943. Who wants to bet it was Harry Hopkins on the other end opening up the pouch? No bet. I already know the answer. Just before Earle departed the United States to become FDR's special emissary in Istanbul, officially naval attaché, he wrote the following letter on December 19, 1942, from New York City on Ritz-Carlton stationery. Dear Harry, if you don't mind, I'm going to report to you direct my activities. I like the way your mind works, and I know you will sort out what you think of importance enough for the president. Maybe Harry thought George meant throw out? As I examined this letter, which I came across in a miscellaneous folder of Hopkins' correspondence at Georgetown University Library, I found something puppy-doggedly ingenuous about Earle coming through his round, bold handwriting on the page. The letter, by the way, probably wasn't where it belonged, and thank goodness. The single designated file of Earle Hopkins' correspondence I discovered is specified by label to span from June 3, 1943, to November 22, 1944. There is no file in the Hopkins collection for any earlier Earle correspondence, no epistolary record from the time in January 1943 when Earle arrived in Istanbul and shortly thereafter came into contact with anti-Hitler Germans, including Abwehr Chief Canaris and German ambassador to Turkey, Franz von Papen, and, as we know from Earle's account, wrote Hopkins and Roosevelt all about it. Where did these letters go? Had the record been cleaned out? Had I stumbled across my own black hole of anti-knowledge? The one Earle file, Folder 6, was, according to its description in the index, supposed to contain correspondence from George Earle in a folder marked Sidney Hyman, compiled by Sherwood in his book on Hopkins. Folder contents have been maintained in their provenance prior to arrival at Georgetown University. Really? The only clue I could find to explain what appears to be a grievous hole in the record is a single typed sentence on the final sheet of this file. previous correspondence to and from Lieutenant Commander George Earle was packed and sent to Mr. Hopkins' home, November 22, 1944, for his use. His use was packed? What for? By whom? Then what happened? There are no answers to these questions. A librarian looked at me helplessly. Someone gutted the historical record, and we are left to our own devices to collect and piece together the fragments of this shocking, shaming history that this same someone, it seems, very much didn't want anyone to find out about. So here goes. Without undertaking a history of the anti-Nazi Germans, suffice it to say we see significant contact with the British by 1938. By 1942, Canaris had a plan before British intelligence that was under serious consideration, but, of course, went nowhere. Earle tells us Canaris came to see him in Istanbul early in 1943, following Roosevelt's stunning announcement of an Allied policy of unconditional surrender on January 24, 1943, the final day of the Casablanca conference with Churchill. Did FDR really mean what he said, Canaris wanted to know? Was there anything more to talk about? Earle reported the incident faithfully to FDR, he wrote 15 years later in Confidential magazine. His dispatch went off by plane in the next diplomatic pouch. I waited patiently for his reply, Earle wrote. Yes, to keep our story thread straight, these German-American peace feelers began probing, at about the same time, former U.S. ambassador to the USSR, William C. Bullitt, presented FDR with his prophetic blueprint of what the post-war world would look like if Anglo-American appeasement of Stalin didn't stop. Perhaps ironically, also at this same time, on February 1, 1943, Army intelligence finally decided to open the canvas bags of encoded Soviet messages that had been accumulating since 1939, when telegraph companies were ordered to turn over copies of cable traffic between Soviet missions in the United States and Moscow after the signing of the Nazi-Soviet Pact. This would become the Venona Project, and, according to the Schechters, the idea was to read Soviet cables to better understand Soviet thinking and thus be better allies. No kidding. No one seemed to have had an inkling that U.S. codebreakers would, in reading or partly reading, a reported 2,900 messages out of an estimated 2 million, uncover a giant complex of American traitors at work for the Soviet Union. Stalin, meanwhile, continued hectoring Roosevelt on an array of supposed Anglo-American inadequacies. Bullitt's prophecy aside, Roosevelt continued to appease and placate Stalin. Roosevelt to Stalin, February 22, 1943.
I regret equally with you that the Allied effort in North Africa did not proceed in accordance with the schedule, which was interrupted by unexpectedly heavy rains. I fully realize the adverse effect. I am taking every possible step. I can assure you we are making maximum effort. I understand the importance of military efforts on the continent of Europe at the earliest practicable date in order to reduce Axis resistance to your heroic army.
About that army...
On behalf of the people of the United States, FDR wrote in a second cable to Stalin on February 22, 1943, I want to express to the Red Army on its 25th anniversary our profound admiration for its magnificent achievements unsurpassed in all history.
Slurp, slurp. Little wonder then, really, that on March 4, 1943, Maxim Litvinov, the Soviet ambassador, felt emboldened enough to visit Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells at his office, where Litvinov left him with a list of officials who supposedly were undermining American relations with Russia, and who would be purged, American style, by June 1943, as noted earlier. Little wonder, too, that after Standley, the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, talked Turkey to the press in Moscow on March 8, 1943, about Soviet efforts to deny Lend-Lease contributions to the USSR, the White House set about replacing him. Meanwhile, Moscow was at the same moment trolling the USA and Canada for uranium. Back to Earl. One morning in March, Earl wrote, the phone rang and he recognized the voice of Canaris. I'm the gentleman who called on you unannounced 2 months ago. Has there been any progress in the matter we discussed? No, Earl said, no progress. I am very sorry, Canaris replied and hung up. The German spy chief would try again to reach Churchill that year, traveling blindfolded to the Paris convent that, amazingly, served as British intelligence headquarters in Nazi-occupied France. Earl never heard from him again. He would, however, hear much more from Canaris's fellow conspirators. On April 3, 1943, 10 days before the Katyn Forest massacre became known to the world, NKVD officer Elizabeth Zarubina met for the first time with Franz L. Neumann, a brand new KGB recruit on the German desk at the OSS in Washington. With so much Soviet espionage activity going on, why is this particular meeting significant? Neumann, a leading light of the so-called Frankfurt School, poison gas incubator of such noxious theories as cultural Marxism, political correctness, and critical theory, was already passing secret documents to his Soviet masters. Soon, he would also be writing top-secret memos for U.S. intelligence, analyzing the potential of anti-Nazi groups in Germany. Guess what? Neumann tended to see more promise in German workers, read communists, than in German conservatives, or anti-communists, as he explained in memos to American intelligence. For example, later on, after von Stauffenberg's failed coup and attempt on Hitler's life in July 1944, Neumann assessed the anti-Nazi plotters thus. The group represented nothing more than bankrupt generals, nationalist intellectuals, and possibly nationalist social democrats and civil servants. Bankrupt generals aside, nationalist was a buzzword as bad as isolationist. Incidentally, it still is. Nevertheless, such was the word from what was, in effect, Neumann's NKVD desk at the OSS. No doubt to the satisfaction of his NKVD controller, Zarubina, also the wife of KGB spy chief and, quote, diplomat Zerubin Zubilin, whose own espionage activities, of course, would prompt Harry Hopkins to inform the Soviet embassy that the FBI was listening in. Quite a tightly wrapped cluster of Soviet interests, no? I'm not exactly suggesting a harmonic convergence. For one thing, the discipline of communist cells often ensured an amazing degree of anonymity among agents. At the top of the OSS, for example, Duncan Lee, Wild Bill Donovan's aide and KGB source, had no idea that his old friend and OSS employee Donald Wheeler was also working for the KGB and was probably the KGB's most productive source, according to Haynes, Clare, and Vasiliev. That said, it doesn't seem unreasonable to note the overlap in purpose, task, and mission across so few degrees of separation. Neumann, after all, was a red pea in a pod along with his more enduringly famous OSS colleague and Frankfurt School co-founder, Herbert Marcuse, yet another German-born Marxist analyzing top-secret American intelligence for the OSS. Yes, your hair should be standing on end. Was Marcuse an NKVD agent too? His relationship with Soviet intelligence remains unconfirmed. Re Herbert Marcuse. We have taken an interest in him in connection with his work for The Cabin, a KGB document of the same vintage, January 1943, reports. Cabin means OSS. The KGB report noted that Marcuse was a close friend of Neumann's. Marcuse would marry Neumann's widow in 1954, and he was very close to Communist Party members back in Germany. 20 years later, Marcuse would also be very close to the 1960s anti-war movement. No, I don't digress. It's all of a scary piece. It is revelations such as these that must come together in a new, communist-conscious American narrative of World War II and the world, our world, that formed in the war's aftermath. Without it, we remain ill-equipped to understand ourselves or our world. It turns out the war narrative does not begin on December 7th, 1941, a day which will live in infamy, and end on August 14th, 1945, after the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, soon to be sealed with Alfred Eisenstadt's photograph of the ultimate kiss in Times Square. My new war narrative is different. It burns more quietly inside beige government offices and impersonal conference rooms, where, in sunlight and shadow, striated by the wooden slats of mid-century Venetian blinds, Alger Hiss, Virginius Frank Coe, Lawrence Duggan, Julian Wadley, Harold Glasser, and Lachlan Curry, all confirmed Soviet agents, made their contributions to post-war foreign policy preparation. It goes on even inside busy downtown restaurants, such as the venerable Old Ebbitt Grill, where, in the spring of 1941, KGB agent Harry Dexter White received his Operation Snow espionage orders from Vitaly Pavlov, right across the street from White's office at the Treasury Department. White, as we have seen, was told to insert certain demands into the State Department's cable flow to Tokyo, specific language crafted in Moscow, purposefully to bring the United States and Japan to war by the end of 1941, which he did and which it did. This new war narrative takes place also inside the Justice Department and around Capitol Hill, where, in late June 1941, as Robert Stripling wrote in his memoir, the acting Attorney General informed Representative Martin Dies that, after discussing the question with the President and Secretary Hull, he was denying permission to the House Committee on Un-American Activities to hold hearings on Japanese spying on the Pacific Coast and in Hawaii. Why? Stripling, of course, knew nothing of Operation Snow at that very moment in progress, but his sense of the impact that hearings on Japanese espionage activity could have had makes it clear that their cancellation, for whatever reason, furthered the Soviet plot to push Japan and the United States to war. For the remainder of my life, Stripling wrote in 1949, I will always believe that our disclosures would have aroused enough alarm among our people to have caused the Japanese to abandon their planned attack on Pearl Harbor. The forces of exposure were thwarted again. Lighting up Japan's dark designs on American territory would have rung an alarm for Americans, quite likely resulting in hasty Japanese recalculations, including retreat. That wasn't in the master plan, in Moscow's master plan. As Peter Niblo writes in Influence, Moscow, of course, urgently needed the Pearl Harbor attack to succeed. Could the Justice decision, the result of consultations with the White House, input from Hopkins, input from Curry, and the State Department, input from Hiss, advice from IPR, have been cobbled together in concert with, under pressure from, due to indirect influence of the force field emanating from Operation Snow. I don't know the answer, but the record shows that whatever Moscow urgently needed, Moscow usually got. They needed a weapons and materiel lifeline, and they got Lend-Lease, which, as we've seen, came together after a successful triple play of Stalin's influence team, Hammer to Hopkins to White. They needed the Japanese to drive south in the Pacific, away from Soviet interests, and they got, among other things elaborated on by Peter Niblo and others, Operation Snow, which helped precipitate Pearl Harbor. They needed that second front, but only in northern France, to keep Anglo-American forces from landing in southern Europe, and they got Overlord and Anvil, thanks, in some significant measure, to the labors of Harry Hopkins. They needed to neutralize the anti-Nazi, anti-communist opposition in Germany to facilitate their expansion into eastern and central Europe, and they got that too. Who helped that along? Hopkins, likely, standing over the diplomatic pouch. But this, as we'll see, was a group effort. What else did Moscow urgently need? The destruction of Germany. That would be laid out in the Morgenthau Plan of 1944, another Harry Dexter White special. Meanwhile, though, is it possible that Roosevelt's policy of unconditional surrender, which virtually guaranteed the destruction of Germany, was in any part the creation of yet another influence operation? Unconditional surrender is usually portrayed as having sprung whole and spontaneously from Roosevelt's lips, much, as we've seen, as Lend-Lease is usually and inaccurately portrayed. According to sources such as Roosevelt's son Elliot, FDR himself established the unconditional surrender policy on the spur of the moment. The thought popped into my mind, and the next thing I knew, I had said it. This was not at all the case, as even Sherwood points out, and much later, a generation later, State Department records of the January 1943 Casablanca Conference make clear. Such gratuitous myth-making, such a gratuitous lie, is strange in and of itself. Actually, the entire official record, such as it is strange. A footnote in the State Department Casablanca Conference records describes this controversial surrender policy as having been the brainchild of one of those quasi-official State Department come Council on Foreign Relations panels that sprang up right before the war, with Roosevelt being informally briefed at some point after May 1942 and before January 1943. So much for the spontaneity myth. The State Department, meanwhile, certainly wasn't behind it, or even in the loop. But what else is new? Immediately preceding the Casablanca Conference on January 7, 1943, State Department minutes tell us Roosevelt brought up unconditional surrender with his U.S. military chiefs as a fait accompli to raise with Churchill, who knew nothing about it at this point, to discuss the advisability of informing Mr. Stalin of their intentions. More pins in the spontaneity bubble. On January 24, 1943, announcement day in Casablanca, Sherwood reports Roosevelt spoke on background, not for quotation, to reporters, speaking from several pages of notes that had been carefully prepared in advance. While we don't have a record of what was said, what Sherwood calls notes sounds more like polished text. Knowing how closely Hopkins worked with Roosevelt, it's reasonable to assume Hopkins prepared or at least edited the written statement. Quite notably, however, the very first use of the phrase unconditional surrender at Casablanca was by Harry Hopkins himself. In a January 23, 1943 meeting, one day ahead of the president's sensational announcement, Hopkins told the Grand Vizier of Morocco, "The war will be pursued until Germany, Italy, and Japan agree to unconditional surrender." Those were his very words. Clearly, Harry Hopkins was at least on board with the policy. We don't know whether he was driving it, but we have to wonder. I'm taking these pains to describe this policy and the means by which it became Allied doctrine, however, because unconditional surrender may well be what cemented our ultimate defeat. Is that too harsh a formulation? Let me rephrase. Because unconditional surrender may well be the policy that ensured Soviet dominion over half of Europe. It was also, as Ian Colvin noted in the preface to a 1957 edition of his Canaris biography, a pivotal point in the tragedy of the German underground. Unconditional surrender would set the strategy of Allied total war as the only appropriate response to German total guilt. Such a strategy presumed, indeed, drew inspiration from a belief in the unwavering, monolithic German support for Nazism and Hitler, which the very existence of a significant anti-Nazi German resistance movement belied. For the sake of the policy, then, the significant anti-Nazi German resistance movement had to be denied, shut out. Otherwise, total war and the total destruction it required wasn't justified. Otherwise, I say, Stalin wouldn't win. General Wiedemeyer devotes an entire chapter of his memoir to making the devastating strategic case against unconditional surrender. The general did not mince words. "We annulled the prospect of winning a real victory by the Casablanca call for unconditional surrender," he wrote. Why did we do that? Our demand for unconditional surrender naturally increased the enemy's will to resist and forced even Hitler's worst enemies to continue fighting to save their country. This will to resist would only intensify with the September 1944 leak of the Morgenthau plan for the pasteurization of Germany noted below. Many leading Allied officials shared Wiedemeyer's concern about the unifying, animating effect FDR's declaration would have on Germany, fearing it would prolong the fighting, ensuring that it would be all last ditch and to the bitter end. On the other side, too, the view is the same. In the book The German Generals Talk, Liddell Hart writes, "All to whom I talked dwelt on the effect of unconditional surrender policy on prolonging the war. They told me that but for this, they and their troops, the factor that was more important, would have been ready to surrender sooner, separately or collectively." Wiedemeyer elaborated, "We failed to realize that unconditional surrender and the annihilation of German power would result in a tremendous vacuum in Central Europe into which the communist power and ideas would flow." About that vacuum in Central Europe, is it the case that we simply failed to realize that a vacuum would emerge? Or had enough of us instead bought the Moscow Line, that Stalin wanted nothing more than the security for his country? As Roosevelt, invoking Harry Hopkins, told William Bullitt at this same fateful moment. What about those among us in positions of power who had already decided that Stalin in Europe would be a good thing? Remember Hanson Baldwin's numero uno, great mistake of the war, the belief that the Politburo had abandoned its policy of world communist revolution and was honestly interested in the maintenance of friendly relations with capitalist governments. Where did that belief, that propaganda, come from? Wiedemeyer explains, "We poisoned ourselves with our own propaganda and let the communist serpent we took to our bosom envenom our minds and distort our ideals." Baldwin is more matter of fact. "We became victims of our own propaganda," he wrote. "Russian aims were good and noble. Communism had changed its spots." We were victims, all right, but not of our own propaganda. It was their propaganda. It was propaganda conceived in Moscow and disseminated by bona fide Kremlin agents, mouthpieces, and organizers of communist parties, fellow travelers, and many, many dupes, liberals, all the best people, opinion makers, etc. Our message wasn't our own anymore, because our perception of reality itself had been subverted, and by brilliant, lucky, spontaneous, concerted, fateful, inexorable design. Sometimes this was subtle stuff. Often it was as stark as a censor's black marker. Some of the more shocking confirmation comes from an illuminating 2010 book called Hollywood's War with Poland, 1939 to 1945, by M.B.B. Biskupski. A victim of Soviet aggression since the Nazi-Soviet pact was consummated in the Nazi-Soviet invasion of Poland in 1939, Poland, Biskupski documents, was consistently denigrated in Hollywood's effort to boost the Allied war effort, an effort overseen by communists and fellow travelers in the chock-full of Commies' Office of War Information and its similarly progressive spin-off, the Bureau of Motion Pictures. Often, this was by sin of omission, what Biskupski calls the occupation subgenre of the Hollywood war movie, for example, was invariably set in Britain, France, or Norway, never Poland. Biskupski also explains how Victor Laszlo, the Czech resistance hero in Casablanca, co-written by noted Hollywood lefty or Stalinist Howard Koch, one of the unfriendly 19 later called before Congress, could never have been a Polish national in pro-Soviet Hollywood. Indeed, among the multinational refugees crowding Rick's Café Américain, there are Austrians, Germans, Russians, Czechs, French, Norwegians, even Bulgarians, but no Poles. Nor is Poland mentioned in a Nazi character's listing of underground movements, despite being home to Europe's largest underground movement. There were sins of commission, too, drawing from a memorandum in the BMP files Biskupski describes how the U.S. government baldly called for pro-Soviet propaganda to be inserted directly into the 1944 MGM movie Song of Russia. Namely, that the movie script explained the Hitler-Stalin pact as only an expedient, and the Soviet invasions of Finland and Poland as defensive gestures. These same expedient and defensive measures, by the way, would constitute German, but not Soviet, war crimes at the Nuremberg trials. There's more. Not only was the United States government directing MGM, a private movie studio, to disseminate Soviet propaganda, the BMP chief, an American public servant, sent the MGM script to the first secretary of the Russian embassy in Washington, Vladimir Bazykin, who offered specific wording to bring the script into conformity with the Kremlin line. Such wording was indeed specific. According to Biskupski, in the inserted dialogue, the character who suggests the Hitler-Stalin pact revealed cooperation between the Soviets and the Germans is shown to be wrong and is embarrassed by his fatuity. Soviet agitprop. It was everywhere. Stanislaw Mikołajczyk, prime minister of the Polish government in exile, felt compelled to lodge a complaint with the State Department about American broadcasts into wartime Poland by the red-riddled OWI, because, he wrote, the U.S. government's pro-Soviet propaganda duplicated the broadcasts sent from Moscow. Indeed, these American broadcasts, Mikołajczyk continued, might well have emanated from Moscow. Basically, they did. So I have to wonder, why not unconditional surrender, too? Given how many U.S. war policies and strategies may be traced back to Moscow and its minions, it seems worth considering. Another example. One of the great moments in Soviet deception history took place when FDR, magnanimously, he thought, handed off an OSS document on Yugoslavia, lyrical in its praise of Tito, as M. Stanton Evans notes, to Stalin himself at Tehran, except that the document in question was in fact Soviet disinformation as prepared by a KGB contact in the OSS for American consumption. It was designed to build support for the communist leader Tito and undermine support for the anti-Nazi, anti-communist leader Draha Mihailovich, which it did. After an intense Soviet disinformation campaign spearheaded by KGB agent James Klugman from his Cairo perch in British intelligence, the Allies were persuaded to drop all support of Mikhailovich and support Tito, who would establish a communist despotism, hunt down Mikhailovich, put him on show trial, and execute him. With this complex of deception operations underway in mind, I went back to the State Department footnote on the mysterious origins of unconditional surrender policy. In tiny print, it says that the policy was first affirmed on May 6, 1942, the day of the surrender of Corregidor, and reaffirmed on May 20, 1942. To wit, the Subcommittee on Security Problems of the Advisory Committee on Post-War Foreign Policy at its third meeting on May 6, 1942, began a consideration of armistice and unconditional surrender. According to the minutes of the subcommittee, quick agreement on the matter was reached. Unquote. Quick agreement on such a weighty issue with so many opponents in the military and diplomatic establishment seems a tad hasty. But the minutes continue. The subcommittee agreed to begin its discussion with the assumption that unconditional surrender would be exacted from the principal defeated states. Then, the subcommittee reaffirmed its support for unconditional surrender at its fourth meeting on May 20, 1942, from the minutes. There was considerable discussion of whether an unconditional surrender, rather than an armistice, must be exacted of the principal enemy states. Could this have been a squabble? It continued. It was held that, while unconditional surrender would undoubtedly be preferable if the military situation permitted, study should also be given to possible conditions of an armistice and possible conditions of a negotiated peace. The footnote goes on to note that the president was informally apprised of the subcommittee's views by its head, Norman L. Davis, a well-known diplomat and disarmament advocate. It seems clear that there still existed a divide on the issue. So, which officials might have been on the side of quick agreement? Here are some guesses, culled from the roster of the subcommittee's parent advisory committee. Lachlan Curry, Lawrence Duggan, Alger Hiss, Julian Wadley, Harry Dexter White. Yes, there's a partial roll call of the KGB All-Stars in Washington. Also working in and around this same key advisory committee were other spies, Virginius Frank Coe and Harold Glasser. We might also note the presence on the committee of White House aide David K. Niles, not only for his own communist connections, but because he spoke in a sense for Harry Hopkins in accord with the wishes of the president, as the State Department record states. Did they influence the subcommittee debate on unconditional surrender? It is difficult to say, given the anonymous bureaucracy in which such momentous policy was made. Secretary of State Hull, meanwhile, had absolutely no clue as to when or how unconditional surrender became U.S. policy. In his memoir discussion of unconditional surrender, Hull offers a sad little tagline to the disconnection between his office and policymaking. Originally, this principle had not formed part of the State Department's thinking. We were as much surprised as Mr. Churchill. In our post-war planning discussion in the State Department, which had begun more than 3 years prior to the Casablanca Conference, we had not embraced the idea of unconditional surrender. No, we had not. But that subcommittee of an advisory committee under our aegis had. The 47th and longest-serving Secretary of State wouldn't get the message until after it was out of Roosevelt's mouth. Hopkins biographer George McJimsey argues that Roosevelt was determined to make the announcement about unconditional surrender at Casablanca because he saw the doctrine as an approach to Stalin, a device, along with Lend-Lease aid and the promise of a second front, for convincing Stalin of his goodwill. In other words, it served as a blandishment first, not for speeding the end of the war, but for enhancing the U.S.-USSR relationship, increasingly the American priority. As such, then, it seems that the unconditional surrender policy itself had to be protected from everything, including, it seems, the end of the war, particularly an end to the war that was premature. In other words, before the Soviet Union's enemy Germany was destroyed and, presumably, its own army was in place, to repeat, the anti-Nazi, anti-communist resistance never had a chance because our government wanted a relationship with the USSR more than our government wanted to end the war. Thus, our government took all precautions. When Louis Lochner, for many years the AP bureau chief in Berlin, attempted to file a story on the activities of anti-Nazi Germans operating out of France in October 1944, U.S. military censors blocked the story. Why? The government official in charge of censorship was forthcoming enough to confide to Lochner that there was a personal directive from the President of the United States in his capacity of commander-in-chief forbidding all mention of the German resistance. So writes Klaus P. Fischer in his 2011 book, Hitler and America, drawing from Lochner's 1956 memoir, Always the Unexpected. Fischer quotes Lochner's explanation for this seemingly inexplicable and outrageous censorship. Stories of the existence of a resistance movement did not fit into the concept of unconditional surrender. Exactly. And this was precisely what Ian Colvin was writing about in 1951. Meanwhile, who benefited most from the concept? Stalin. Lochner continued, "My belief that President Roosevelt was determined to establish the guilt of the entire German people, and not only the Nazi regime for bringing on World War II, had already received confirmation in the summer of 1942. Turns out, Lochner knew Roosevelt personally, and both men had a mutual friend in Prince Louis Ferdinand of Prussia. Lochner had been in touch with the anti-Hitler opposition in Germany since 1939. In November 1941, German anti-Nazis asked Lochner, heading home on leave, to contact the president on their behalf, to ask Roosevelt to speak out about what form of government he would like to see take shape in post-Hitler Germany, and to provide the president with secret radio codes so that Americans and German anti-Nazis could communicate directly with each other. So writes Peter Hoffman in The History of the German Resistance, 1933-1945, which first appeared in Germany in 1969, drawing from the 1955 German edition of Lochner's memoir, certain details of which, Hoffman says, are not in the English version. Lochner was interned by the Nazi regime at the outbreak of the war in December 1941 and didn't reach Washington until the summer of 1942. This would have been shortly after unconditional surrender was affirmed and reaffirmed by the president's post-war advisory council subcommittee, and shortly after Roosevelt had promised a second front to Soviet Minister Molotov. Lochner immediately informed the White House that he had personal and confidential messages for the president from the prince and secret information on resistance groups in Germany that he might not confide to anyone else. No answer. No interest. Lochner's attempts at gaining an audience in June 1942 failed. Lochner followed up with a letter and received no reply. Finally, he was informed by the White House through the AP Bureau in Washington, Hoffman writes, that there was no desire to receive his information and he was requested to refrain from further efforts to transmit it. It was a terse response, Fisher adds, quoting Lochner to the effect that his persistence was most embarrassing. Most embarrassing? To whom? Who wrote that terse response? I have not been able to learn the answers to these questions, but Hoffman reveals an important piece of the puzzle in a footnote. Lochner's final attempt to reach Roosevelt on June 19, 1942, was in a letter addressed to a trusted presidential aide. That aide was Lachlan Curry. If this were a movie, forks of lightning would crack and light a black sky over the White House. I don't think we actually can say the buck stopped there, at Soviet agent Curry's desk, but it looks as if this gesture from the anti-Nazi German resistance did. Such good Germans might have spoiled the chances for both unconditional surrender, recently reaffirmed in May 1942, and, of course, Stalin's Second Front, the subject of Molotov's secret discussions with Hopkins, also in May 1942. Given the stunning Axis victory at Tobruk on June 21, 1942, this White House brush-off of anti-Nazi German resistance hardly seems to be in the Allies' best interests, only in Stalin's best interests. This means war to the end, the destruction of Germany as a military power, and the emergence of Russia as the dominating force in Europe, Abwehrchef Wilhelm Canaris had told George Earle in his Istanbul hotel room following the conclusion of what Roosevelt himself called the Unconditional Surrender Conference in January 1943. What Canaris didn't think to ask was whether Roosevelt actually objected to such a ghastly outcome. I think it's fair to say Roosevelt did not so object. Indeed, he seems to have looked forward to it. The next approach to Earle, also in that spring of 1943, came from Baron Kurt von Lersner, a German aristocrat of Jewish extraction. He, too, had a proposal for the Allies. Earle wrote, "According to Lersner, and I could not doubt him, he had placed his life in my hands. Some of the highest officials in Germany, Papen included, loved their country but hated Hitler. They wanted to end the war before he bled Germany of all her youth, all her strength and resources. At the same time, they were deeply concerned about Russia's growing might and power." Unbeknownst to Earle, fostering Russia's growing might and power seemed to have become the purpose of our war. Earle wrote, "What Lersner wanted to know was this. If they delivered the German army to the Allies, could they then count on Allied cooperation in keeping Russian troops out of Germany and her buffer states to the east?" Earle sent off another dispatch to FDR at the White House marked urgent. Again, Earle received no reply. "I pressed the matter with every ounce of my persuasion and judgment," Earle wrote, "but I sensed the old trouble. Lersner's call for an overt stand against communist expansion distressed Roosevelt. It really distressed Hopkins. It's even possible Harry Hopkins made the decision to ignore Earls offers from the German underground himself. Or, if Hopkins brought FDR into his deliberations, he certainly managed to convince him to ignore Canaris. Hopkins' star was easily that high. All that summer, Lerzner asked and pleaded for encouragement, Earl wrote. I had nothing for him from the White House. There was nothing to say. Earl wrote that his German contacts came back to him with another, more specific plan, laying out the involvement of Field Marshal Ludwig Beck, Count Wolf Heinrich von Heldorf, Chief of Police of Berlin, Prince Gottfried Bismarck, a Potsdam official and grandson of the Iron Chancellor, and a well-known cavalry officer, Freiherr von Boselager. Again, the plan was to stage a coup, turn over Hitler and his top henchmen to the Allies, and bring about Germany's unconditional surrender with one condition. The Russians were not to be allowed into Central Europe, including Germany or territory at that time controlled by Germany. Earl sent this dispatch off with high hopes, he wrote. Maybe it was the specificity of the plan, but Earl really got into the spirit of it this time. Papen had a plane standing by. When the president's word came through, Earl wrote, he, Earl, would drive out to the airport in his lieutenant commander's uniform and fly to Berlin. I felt this way. I might not come back, Earl wrote. If I didn't, I wanted to go out in an American uniform. Earl even wrote farewell letters. They sat. He sat. Days, weeks passed. Lerzner kept checking in. Earl doesn't specify how much time went by, but finally an answer from the president came through. It was stiff and impersonal.
All such applications for a negotiated peace should be referred to the Supreme Allied Commander, General Eisenhower, Roosevelt wrote.
The reference to Eisenhower's rank dates the reply to after Eisenhower was promoted in December 1943. Earl explains, in diplomatic language, this was the final runaround. Even if we did get to Eisenhower, the matter would be referred back to Roosevelt for a decision. The president's answer was therefore a clear indication of his complete disinterest in this plan to end the war. I couldn't explain to Lerzner. I didn't even try. Now the question. What if Lochner's query had been received with natural interest and acted on in mid-1942? What if the U.S. government had initiated contact with the anti-Hitler opposition at that point and supported a successful coup against Hitler in Germany? Or what if 6 months later, Canaris, Hitler's secret opponent, had been encouraged to produce the defection of the German army and negotiate its surrender to the Allies? What if one of the subsequent serious attempts that other opponents of Hitler made through various Anglo-American emissaries in 1942, 1943, and 1944 had been able to overthrow the Führer, close down the concentration camps, abort the final solution, thwart Soviet conquests in Europe and Asia, call off every battle from Monte Cassino to D-Day to the Warsaw Uprising to the Battle of the Bulge, avoid the destruction of city centers from Hamburg to Dresden, and save the lives of millions and millions and millions of people in between. The scale of suffering that might have been averted, and equally as important for the psyche of civilization, might never have been imagined, is too vast and deep to grasp, too massively crushing to entertain, like a black hole from space in your living room. But there it is. World War II could have ended years earlier, had communists working for Moscow not dominated Washington, quashing every anti-Nazi, anti-communist attempt beginning in late 1942, throughout 1943 and 1944, to make common cause with Anglo-American representatives. Their main condition, Allied support on keeping Russian troops out of Eastern and Central Europe, was an instant deal-breaker, the Red Line. No, the anti-Red Line. Neither the communist-occupied British government nor the communist-occupied American government would dare to cross. Sure, we would spend the next 40 years trying to keep communism from spreading westward. But at more propitious moments to save Central and Eastern Europe, we wouldn't, couldn't even consider trying. Later, the impact of unconditional surrender would be magnified by the September 1944 leak of the Morgenthau Plan, the Roosevelt White House Plan, Harry Dexter White's plan to pasteurize and deindustrialize and dismember Germany. In other words, destroy all science, industry, and technology in Germany, just for starters. If unconditional surrender poured the oil to reignite German fires in 1943, the Morgenthau Plan was high-octane propaganda for the Nazis to work with in 1944 until the bitter end. Almost overnight, the morale of the German people seems wholly changed, said GOP presidential candidate Governor Thomas E. Dewey on October 18, 1944, during Roosevelt's fourth and final campaign. Now they are fighting with a frenzy of despair. Roosevelt's own son-in-law, Lieutenant Colonel John Bettinger, estimated that the Morgenthau Plan was worth 30 divisions to the Germans. General Marshall, too, would complain to Morgenthau that the plan appeared to have stiffened German resistance. General Omar Bradley talked about the near miraculous revitalization of the German army in October 1944, after news of the plan had leaked. In his autobiographical account of World War II, former CIA Director William Casey confirmed that fear of Germany being turned into a potato patch was driving German forces, as captured letters from frontline troops showed. John Dietrich, who gathered these and more observations of the plan's war-prolonging impact in his devastating 2002 book, The Morgenthau Plan, Soviet Influence on American Postwar Policy, writes, "There is no way of calculating the number of American servicemen who lost their lives as a result of this policy. It's quite possible," he continues, "that Hitler was able to use German fear of the plan to mount his final major offensive in the West, in the Ardennes." That hits home. I mentioned earlier that my dad was wounded at San Lo in July 1944. After a quick fix in a British hospital and an odyssey across Northern Europe, he probably would have been arrested for being AWOL if he hadn't been heading toward the front. To rejoin his unit, practically all replacements, he discovered, he found himself outside the German border town of Monschau in the Northern Ardennes, a beautiful wooded area that spans westernmost Germany and Belgium. It was fall. I doubt he got inside the town itself, because I think he would have mentioned how storybook exquisite it is, as I got to see one recent June. By the time my dad arrived in the forest, it was getting cold, and he was still wearing the lightweight uniform that suited summer in Normandy. Not too surprisingly, he became sick. Coughs, chills, hot potato fever. I think it was the high temperature that triggered his hospital leave as fall became winter, 1944. If his fever hadn't shot up one night, bivouacked under icy moonlight in a snowy Grimm's fairy tale forest on the leading edge of the American line, it's no stretch to say I wouldn't be writing these words. That's because, days later, shortly after he had safely made it to sickbay somewhere behind the front lines, German forces launched their unexpected last-ditch offensive through the Ardennes, the epic fighting best known to us as the Battle of the Bulge. In all, 19,000 Americans were killed before it was all over in late January 1945, making this battle the costliest battle for the United States in the entire war. According to this new way of looking at the war, of course, the Battle of the Bulge, which, like Normandy, happens to bookend my dad's personal fight to liberate Europe from the Nazis, or, rather, his personal fight to liberate Europe for the Soviets, never should have taken place. It never would have taken place if it hadn't been for the communist occupation of Washington. Without that, this most destructive of all wars would likely have ended before it became most destructive. As for my dad, who, as an 18-year-old at Erasmus High School in Brooklyn, had parlayed my grandpa's job as a Lowe's MGM movie theater manager into a job as a script boy at MGM, he might never have had to leave the lot in Culver City for basic training in 1943, certainly would have gotten no further than Fort Riley, and I have no doubt, like tens of thousands of other young American men, would have been frustrated at not having seen any military action in the course of a life that, I also have no doubt, would have taken some different track. As would have the whole world. Had the war ended 2 incalculably costly years earlier, we all would inhabit a different place, physically and mentally. At the end of 1942, the Great War reporter Ernie Pyle described the fighting men he was living alongside in North Africa, specifically the transformation that had changed these first American troops in combat in Europe from homesick young men into soldiers whose days become full of war instead of American days simply transplanted to Africa. Pyle continued, poignantly and presciently, offering his American readers insights into a transformation of greater proportions. Our men can't make this change from normal citizens into warriors and remain the same people. Even if they were away from you this long under normal circumstances, the mere process of maturing would change them, and they would not come home just as you knew them. Add to that the abnormal world they have been plunged into, the new philosophies they have had to assume or perish inwardly, the horrors and delights and strange wonderful things they have experienced, and they are bound to be different people from those you sent away. It wasn't only that they were rougher, Pyle wrote, or that their language had changed from mere profanity to obscenity, or that they missed women and showed the absence of the gentling effect of femininity. Pyle saw something else. Our men have less regard for property than you raised them to have. An unexpected observation, he continued. Money value means nothing to them, either personally or in the aggregate. They are fundamentally generous with strangers and with each other. They give or throw away their own money, and it is natural that they are even less thoughtful of bulk property than of their own hard-earned possessions. It is often necessary to abandon equipment they can't take with them. The urgency of war prohibits normal caution in the handling of vehicles and supplies. One of the most striking things to me about war is the appalling waste that is necessary. At the front, there just isn't time to be economical. Also, in war areas where things are scarce and red tape still rears its delaying head, a man learns to get what he needs simply by requisitioning. It isn't stealing. It's the only way to acquire certain things. The stress of war puts old virtues in a changed light. What Pyle describes is a new man in the making, his personality augmented and changed by the state. He is also describing the personality of the new state as augmented and changed by the war, driven on and on, past doomsday. Maybe I'm reading too much into Pyle's observations, but they put me in mind of all the big government wars to come in which big spending on government programs, appalling waste, and the old virtues in a changed light would mark the post-war era of prosperity. And they put me in mind, too, of Harry Hopkins, who certainly would have approved of this new man and this new state, both in significant ways his own creation. Hopkins: I believe people are poor in the main because we don't know how to distribute the wealth properly. I've got away from the notions I once had about a socialist state. I think it can be done under a capitalist economy. WPA showed that. 25 million got their income under that. I think that after this war, if you run up a debt of $200 billion, the country can stand it. We must get the right relationship between government and private enterprise. The government is in this thing and in it for good. Who's we? Not the people. Can't you just hear Harry upstairs at the White House mixing up a sundown shaker of martinis on a roll to FDR as they talk about how we can get this relationship between government and business right? Convergence, a nice name for the fascism, Hopkins described. Here we come, less than the war to make the world safe for democracy, as if. World War II was the war to grease the skids for continued centralized state power everywhere, removing all obstacles, emotional, philosophical, and of course physical. Germany was just another such obstacle. From testimony before the Senate subcommittee investigating interlocking subversion in government departments, May 29, 1952. Senator Eastland: Do you know who drew up the plan, the Morgenthau plan? Miss Bentley: Due to Mr. White's influence to push the devastation of Germany, because that was what the Russians wanted. Senator Ferguson: That was what the communists wanted? Miss Bentley. Definitely, Moscow wanted them completely razed because then they would be of no help to the Allies. Mr. Morris. You say that Harry Dexter White worked on that? Miss Bentley. And on our instructions, he pushed hard. Senator Eastland. What you say is that it was a communist plot to destroy Germany and weaken her to where she could not help us? Miss Bentley. That is correct. She could no longer be a barrier to protect the Western world. Neither, it seems, could we. An increasingly painful realization. In the summer of 1943, Count Helmut James von Moltke, an associate of Canaris, a member of the Kreisau Circle, would take the trip to Istanbul to visit not George H. Earle, but members of the OSS. According to Douglas Waller's 2011 Donovan biography, Moltke was prepared to accept unequivocal military defeat and occupation of Germany. However, Waller continues, pitch perfect in sounding the anti-anti-communist note of the times even in 2011. Moltke's plan was Russophobic. His plan, like the others we've seen, provided for the overthrow of Hitler and the establishment of a provisional anti-Nazi government. The German army would withdraw its forces from the west and hold the Red Army at the Tilsit to Lemberg line in Poland. How Russophobic to want to prevent the Red Army from entering Lithuania and Romania and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Germany and the rest, bringing secret police and devastation with it. No, Moltke's plan was Russo-realistic, a plan to defend liberty in Europe, to save millions from Soviet servitude. Which is why it got nowhere in Russophilic Washington. Moltke returned to Berlin, where he was arrested by the Gestapo and executed in January 1945. More plans took shape, took flight, and were shot down. No one wanted Hitler's head in exchange for Allied help to fend off Russian conquest. No dice. Mustn't offend the Russians. F.W. Winterbotham, chief of air intelligence for MI6, wrote in his memoir, Secret and Personal, that he personally approved of such a plan from Canaris as early as 1942. It would certainly not have pleased Stalin, Winterbotham wrote in 1969. But why we should fall over backwards to appease those who were and are pledged to destroy our way of life, I shall never understand. Never? Maybe now we can understand that a point of secret penetration and subversion had been passed beyond which appeasement was a fundamental principle. I wonder if Winterbotham, a top intelligence official and author of The Ultra Secret, the first popular account of how the Allies broke the German code, would now agree. He died in 1990, pre-Venona and all that, but I wish I could ask him now, with all the evidence that has been amassed, whether we are looking back on something that still defies understanding, as he wrote in 1969, or whether it was something as obvious as it was evil, a successful Soviet influence operation to thwart a separate peace with anti-Nazi Germans in order to enable communist expansion into Europe. I wonder if he or any of the others would now agree that due to the communist penetration in the West, the savage in Berlin remained in power long enough to ruin our world and humanity itself, that under communist influence, not offending Russia became a higher priority than removing Hitler from power, that having created the Soviet Empire by supplying and cooperating with it, we would spend the rest of the century imperiled by it, that we remain forever changed by it. I wonder, too, if deep and unbearable understanding came long ago to such men in the know, to British spymaster Menzies, for example, whose obituary noted that he turned down all invitations to write and be interviewed after he retired in 1951. That was the year Colvin's Canaris biography first came out. Probably a coincidence. Later, in this same all-important year of 1943, in October, 1 month before the fateful Tehran Conference, the first meeting of the Big Three, a young American OSS agent working for the Reader's Digest initiated contact with Franz von Papen, the German ambassador to Turkey, and by this point, hardened, if not cynical, veteran of anti-Nazi Allied intrigue. A devout Catholic, von Papen had also been in talks with Vatican representatives regarding a separate peace between Germany and the British and Americans, much to Moscow's consternation, as a matter of fact. In his 1994 memoir, Soviet spy master Pavel Sudoplatov explained why such an accord would limit communist influence in Europe. The logic and the implications of anti-Nazi German resistance were as obvious then as they are ignored today. Sudoplatov continued, Stalin was so furious, he ordered von Papen be assassinated, since he was the key figure around whom the Americans and the British would build an alternative government to Hitler if they signed a separate peace. The Bulgarian assassin botched the job, he continued, adding, We also had reports without details of a direct American approach to von Papen in Istanbul. I don't know if Sudoplatov was referring to Earl or someone else, but Theodore A. Mord also made such an approach. Mord's October 1943 plan was nothing new. It stipulated the overthrow of Hitler and the Nazi regime. It called for the formation of a provisional government to be overseen by von Papen in exchange for yet-to-be-determined American assistance against the Red Army. Mord wrote lengthy OSS memos about his two conversations with von Papen, which also conveyed von Papen's emphatic belief that the Anglo-American unconditional surrender policy was having a negative effect on anti-Nazi activity. Stalin, by the way, never publicly signed on to it, and indeed undercut his own allies by promising a separate kind of peace to the German people through a communist front known as the Free Germany Committee. Von Papen was similarly convinced that Anglo-American firebombing raids on German cities were doing more to spread communism in Germany than anything else. Von Papen railed against the devastation of such cities as Hamburg, where, in the last week of July in 1943, for example, Anglo-American raids had killed 40,000 people in Operation Gomorrah. Mord conveyed von Papen's plaint. He begged that we stop this horrible bombing, that it was not necessary for us to win the war, that our leaders should realize that they were doing more harm than good. He went on, temporarily losing control of his feelings, and said that the German people were not behind the Nazis, that they were beginning to feel that the Allies must be even worse than the Nazis if they continued this ruthless bombing. And his cities, one by one, will be destroyed by Allied air forces. This line, with its practically biblical cadence, echoes through my mind. It comes from Harry Hopkins' landmark speech to a crowd of thousands at the Russia Aid rally at Madison Square Garden on June 22, 1942. I wonder, is it remarkable that Hopkins promised that German cities would be destroyed one by one in mid-1942, a point still so early in the American War? To be sure, it was natural to hail and wish for and fight for the decisive defeat of Nazi Germany, but the destruction of all German cities, one by one? Does that come under the rubric of acceptable rhetorical flourish, or was he possibly telegraphing communist strategy to destroy Germany? I honestly don't know. Given what we know about the Soviet strategy to destroy Germany, it sounds suspect. It was at about the time of this speech that unconditional surrender was being, in effect, rammed through U.S. government channels in May 1942, just as the big press for Stalin's Second Front was also underway. The basic elements of total war were falling into place, and nothing seemingly could stop it now. Even serious proposals to end the war. This was not an American necessity. This was a Soviet design. It was also in the spring of 1942 that Undersecretary of State Adolf Berle came up with a plan he thought might accelerate the collapse of the Nazi regime. Berle had been eavesdropping on secret German communications via the Magic Decoding Program, and had become aware of cautious peace feelers in the German camp early in 1942. To help this movement along, he planned to publish a secret German cable that revealed the precariousness of Germany's internal situation. So sensational was this secret German document, Burley believed, he expected its release to undermine Germany's morale, thus making the Nazi regime come crashing down, thus saving 500,000 people's lives, he estimated, thus averting the possible use of chemical or biological weapons, and thus preventing, as he put it, the Russians from advancing into Germany. Enter Robert Sherwood. It's quite fascinating, suddenly, to see the role Hopkins' biographer played when Burley consulted the literary light, who was also a keeper of wartime information on various government panels, including OWI, which he headed with Katyn Soviet apologist Elmer Davis. Burley brought Sherwood his plan to expose the secret German communique, a frank inside appraisal of Nazi weakness. Sherwood then assembled a small intelligence group to consider Burley's plan. Edmund Taylor, Wallace Jewell, and James P. Warburg. The latter, by the way, a scion of the famous German-Jewish banking family whose father, Paul M. Warburg, founded the Federal Reserve banking system in 1913. James Warburg is best remembered as an outspoken proponent of world government, whether we like it or not, as he put it to the Senate in 1950, and as a co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies, a crypto-Marxist think tank, in 1963. According to Christoph Mosch, who reported the Burley-Sherwood conversations in his 2002 book, The Shadow War Against Hitler, Sherwood's little group, or cabal, feared that the action, the exposure of Nazi weakness, would have a negative effect on the home fronts in the U.S. and England, possibly reducing public pressure for the opening of a second front in Western Europe. There are different ways to interpret this objection in April 1942. The most benign is that the Sherwood group feared news of Nazi vulnerabilities would only undermine public pressure for the Second Front while simultaneously doing nothing to hasten Nazi collapse. That's possible, although not stated. Burley's feeling, meanwhile, was, as Mosch reported, that the American people would fight harder if they believed victory was assured, and if the Nazi regime did suffer as a result of exposure, would have to fight less. Win-win, no? Maybe not for devotees of world government, however. Maybe they feared that if Burley was right, the war would end too soon, before the so-called creative destruction they yearned for could take place. Maybe such sentiments remained in the unconscious. Maybe such sentiments didn't exist. This is pure speculation on my part. Still, it seems important to try to weigh the arguments that were taking place in wartime Washington when it appeared that the drive for Nazi collapse was taking a back seat to Stalin's wishes for the Second Front, and even to the spread of communist revolution or some more seemingly palatable socialist variant. Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov would be making his historic trip to Washington in just a few weeks' time to push the Second Front in northern France in earnest, with benefit of Harry Hopkins' secret advice. To hypothesize further, premature Nazi collapse would spoil all of these best-laid communist plans. Meanwhile, one document is missing from the archive. In his footnote, Christoph Mosch reports that the intercepted document Burley had such high hopes for, likely procured through the top-secret magic program, cannot be found in the OSS files. It's as if someone, something, some force, some agent or agents set out on a reverse scavenger hunt equipped with razor blades and torches to give our past a lobotomy. However, one thing they, whoever they are, could never do while ransacking our past was change the map. The logic of the map is ours to this day, the key to the secret struggle. Theodore Mord recounted how his first meeting with von Papen in October 1943 ended. As we were about to shake hands in part, von Papen again took my arm and pulled me over to a large map on the wall. "Look at that great space," he said, indicating Russia. "Think what industrial havoc they can do, and what they can do to all Europe. Mord solemnly promised von Papen he would only divulge the details of their discussions to Roosevelt himself. He never got past Paul Watson, a.k.a. General Edwin M. Watson, Roosevelt's secretary. Watson shunted Mord over to Robert Sherwood, whom Mord had worked for in a couple of capacities, which might well explain why Mord hadn't gone to see Sherwood first, including at OWI. Sherwood listened to Mord's story. He wasn't unimpressed by Mord's work. In fact, he was beside himself, livid, over what he described as Mord's dangerous activities. In a memo to FDR on October 26, 1943, Sherwood described Mord's account of his talks with von Papen as amazing, but not, it should be emphasized, in a good way. Sherwood didn't just veto the Mord plan. He proposed that the U.S. government ground Mord. Literally, "I am going to make a full report of this to the acting Secretary of State, with the suggestion that Mord should not again be given a passport to leave this country." Why? Because Mord might actually succeed at bringing about the overthrow of Hitler and a bulwark against Stalin? Impossible to say. Sherwood's memo then descends into an attack against Reader's Digest. The really important part of the whole story lies in the activities abroad of the Reader's Digest. Mord, a Digest writer, had told Sherwood about Digest plans to expand its free circulation among troops serving abroad in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. What could possibly be wrong with that? Everything. According to Sherwood, as you know, Reader's Digest has become more and more bitter and partisan in its attacks on this administration. In its worldwide circulation, it is, in effect, undoing the work that my outfit is constantly trying to do overseas. Reader's Digest? It's hard to imagine the Digest, so solid and soothing that it once appeared in every dentist's waiting room in America, as an attack organization sabotaging the U.S. war effort during World War II. Then again, the Digest was always resolutely anti-communist, and the Roosevelt administration was always resolutely not. I went back to the archives. While reviewing Digest back issues, I actually found plenty of pro-Soviet material in 1943. Maurice Hindus, for example, a giant of Soviet apologetics, published a piece in April 1943 called "The Price Russia is Paying." Then I came to the lead story in the July 1943 edition. Its title is "To Collaborate Successfully, We Must Face the Facts About Russia" by Max Eastman. An ex-socialist of note, Eastman had the distinction of having raised the money to send John Reed to see the Russian Revolution and was the first publisher of what became Reed's 10 Days That Shook the World. Eastman knew whereof he spoke. An excerpt. "That Stalin is an absolute dictator is the simple truth. And it is so important a truth that I am not going to leave it in my own words." Quote, "The Soviet Union, as everybody knows that has the courage to face the facts, is a dictatorship as absolute as any other dictatorship in the world." That statement, made by Franklin D. Roosevelt, February 11, 1940, is as true today as it was then. Another excerpt. "Don't say a word against Stalin or he won't accept our tanks," seems to be the attitude of some of those who are giving away the national treasure so avidly. This is an attitude of spirit, which I find diplomatically foolhardy, morbidly disgraceful, and dangerous to the survival of democratic institutions within this country. Another. "Those eager to be fooled about Russia make eloquent pleas for Stalin's good faith, but Bolsheviks do not believe, even theoretically, in good faith." One more. "People who do not instinctively distinguish between what is true about Russia and what communism and their fellow travelers want us to believe are not to be relied on in this day of democratic crisis." Burn. Little wonder Sherwood was steamed. Eastman refuted every syllable of the U.S. government's pro-Red propaganda. 3 days after Sherwood wrote his memo to FDR about Mord and Reader's Digest, OSS Chief Wild Bill Donovan also sent a memo to FDR about what he called the Mord-Papen plan. Contrary to Sherwood, however, Donovan argued that the plan was quite promising. In fact, as he told Roosevelt, General Patrick Hurley, Roosevelt's personal representative in Cairo, and Colonel Gunther, head of OSS in the Middle East, the only two people apprised of the plan and sworn to secrecy, both considered the Mord-Papen plan feasible. As Donovan put it, rather unctuously, to FDR, it was an idea that your skill and imagination could develop. That was on October 29, 1943. On November 10, 1943, FDR gave his approval to the plan. The plan to deny Theodore A. Mord a U.S. passport. It was a little like trying to put the genie back in the bottle, but it worked. Through silence, sabotage, and secrecy, through the natural attrition and disaffection of those very few in the know, the most promising lifelines out of the war were cut, the death warrants of millions were carried out, and a rich and vital vein of history was lost. It all vanished. The whole frustrating, daring, tragic history of this hapless, unwanted resistance. As if it never happened. Russia uber alles. More than two decades later, 78-year-old Francis Biddle, Roosevelt's attorney general during World War II, received an anonymous letter in the mail. The former Nuremberg judge was sufficiently intrigued by it to inform Gilbert Harrison, then editor of the New Republic. August 28, 1966. Dear Gil, I received, anonymously, the other day from Los Angeles a copy of an extraordinary statement to the effect that former Governor Earle of Pennsylvania was approached by Admiral Canaris, head of Hitler's Secret Service. One nearly complete genocide, two large wars, and many revolutions later, all potentially avertible, had the Allies and anti-Nazi Germans succeeded in ending World War II in 1942 or 1943 or even 1944. And an anonymous letter finally breaks the story of Canaris Earle talks to Biddle, who served 4 years on Roosevelt's wartime cabinet. The news was extraordinary, fantastic. Biddle's letter continues. Earle was presented an offer to be sent to FDR, backed by the German general staff, stating that they would get rid of Hitler and his crew and surrender to the Allies on condition that they be permitted to turn their entire forces against Russia and wipe out the threat of communism. This strange communication is signed the Committee on Patriotism. Perhaps you could run it down. It would be worth an article. Worth an article? Worth a world.